On this podcast, you'll find interviews with high-performing, successful individuals in life sciences. On a weekly basis, we cover their proven methods, principles, strategies, and mindsets to implement new technologies that scale to meet the needs of people in our world.
Hello and welcome to the Life Science Success Podcast. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Don, and I'm a digital marketer and consultant in life sciences. And my guest today is Dr. Rafael Amado. He is from Zai Labs, and we're going to hop right into that question, into that interview. But before we do, we have a quick word from our sponsor.
This episode of Life Science Success is brought to you by D3 Digital Media Marketing. Dive into the digital world with confidence and creativity on your side. D3 Digital Media Marketing is your all-in-one solution for making a lasting impact online. From the vibrant, engaging world of social media marketing, podcasts, and webinars, to the strategic depths of website development, SEO, pay-per-click, email, and content marketing, we tailor our approach to fit your unique brand story. Let's elevate your presence, connect with your audience, and drive success together. Your digital journey starts here. Visit d3digitalmedia.com to learn more. This episode.
And so with that, in today's episode of Life Science Success, we're joined by Dr. Rafael Amado. He's an esteemed leader in oncology research and development, currently serving as the president and head of global oncology at Zai Labs. So with that, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being on. I really appreciate it. Would you mind just telling the listeners just a little bit about yourself and what led you to really want to focus in on oncology as well as gene-engineered cell therapies?
Yes, Don. So I'll start with my sort of vocation for medicine. I'm a physician scientist, and I've been interested in medicine since childhood, really. I was born in Spain. I went to medical school there and then moved to the United States. I did internal medicine first, and then I did a fellowship in hematology oncology at the University of California in Los Angeles. And during my residency, I already knew that I wanted to be an oncologist. And most fellowships are joined hematology oncology, so I'm board certified on both. There were really a few factors that made me think that oncology was really a good specialty for me. So the first was at the time there were a lot of advancements in oncology, particularly in the field of oncogenes, angiogenesis, apoptosis, epigenetics, and many others. So I thought that all these discoveries one day would be translating into therapies and medicines, whereas I wasn't able to see that so palpably with other therapeutic areas. So that was one of them. The other factor was I love medicine and I love treating cancer patients, and being an oncologist really allowed me to continue to be an internist. So I was able to continue to see the patient holistically. I would refer patients to specialists, but I managed a lot of the complications as well. And because oncology has deals with therapies that have toxicities, we have to know about infectious diseases, about cardiology, gastroenterology, etc. So it was more of sort of a holistic approach to patient care that I really enjoyed. And then the third thing is I'm a bit of a detective. I like to figure out what's wrong, and I like the diagnostic process. I obviously like the therapeutic process, but oncology is complex, and there are many diseases, and there are many diagnostic modalities, and practicing oncology is a great way to learn pathology, to learn radiology. That was really, really appealing to me. So those were really the critical aspects. And then, of course, there's the human aspect. And the human aspect really was very palpable as soon as I rotated through the wards as a resident, both in the bone marrow transplant ward and the oncology ward. I saw patients whose lives were transformed from one moment to another with a bad diagnosis, and the impact that therapies would have in those patients was really remarkable in terms of being able to really restore their lives and really be able to live again and see their children get married and go back to work when things went well, but also realize what a big unmet need there was, particularly in patients with metastatic disease. So I thought it was the best way to use my ingenuity to try to improve the life of patients that were in dire need.
Yeah, I mean, I give a lot of credit to people that want to be, you know, oncologists. I mean, I understand the science side of things, but you're seeing people that are have probably received the most life-changing news of their life, and also could be something that quickly ends their life as well if it happens to be, you know, something that we can't treat. Are you in a position now where you're seeing patients, or are you I'm assuming that you're not seeing patients as well in your current role at Zai Labs. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Don. I saw patients for about a dozen years during my fellowship, and also I rotated through the wards in the hospital. We had a solid oncology ward and a bone marrow transplantation ward, and then I saw patients in the clinic. And I also worked in a laboratory. And in the lab is where I started to actually do gene transfer and gene therapy. We started doing this in the very early days of gene therapy. And then I moved on to gastrointestinal malignancies. So I saw patients during that time. And then I joined industry in 2003. And I continued to see patients, but I very quickly realized that it was very difficult to actually make it compatible to do research in industry and see patients. What I do see is a lot of cases that get referred to me, to particularly to see whether there are access to novel therapies, therapies that are under development, or that we may have drugs in development, either internally or what else is out there that, you know, may be promising in a particular disease. So I do like to review these cases and help when I can. And during the course of my career, I've had drugs that, even though they weren't approved, we did like single patient IND or compassionate use. And so that's not really practicing medicine, but it's really interfacing with physicians and I mean, physicians and patients and their families.
Such an important thing to be able to do as well. And yeah, there are people that I know I've interviewed here that have said, you know, many times that they, you know, miss the components of seeing patients, but at the same time can see kind of this bigger world as well, that, you know, they're able to touch many more lives through a lot of the research that they're currently conducting as well.
Absolutely, Don. This is really a paramount reason why I joined industry. Particularly when I was doing GI oncology, we had a dearth of drugs at the time. The drug that was most commonly used was 40 years old, was 5-FU at that time. It's even older now. And then new drugs began to emerge, particularly for colorectal cancer, which is the most common GI malignancy. We still had a great need. And as a matter of fact, I was an investigator in one of the drugs. It was an EGFR inhibitor. And my first industry job was with Amgen. And I actually had the opportunity to transition to Amgen and continue to work on that drug from being an investigator to being now somebody that was championing the approval of that drug. And what a difference that made, because I was able to alter the course of the development of the drug. And we found out, for instance, that that drug doesn't work in patients that have KRAS mutations. Oh. That changed the entire field of colorectal cancer because there was another drug called cetuximab already in the market that was marketed for all patients. So FDA, EMA, and then eventually all the regulatory agencies changed the label for KRAS wild type. KRAS is an oncogene that's common in colorectal cancer. And nowadays, everybody gets genotyped to see whether their colon cancer is KRAS mutated or wild type. So that was incredibly satisfying for me. I wouldn't have been able to do that had I stayed seeing patients. And I would have seen one patient at a time. Now, these drugs and other drugs in colon cancer, such as Avastin and now the immuno-oncology drugs, they have an impact, at least in a subset of patients, that I couldn't have imagined back then. So the impact obviously gets amplified once the drug is out there. Once the drug is developed, it's no longer in our hands. It's in the hands of physicians. And patients are able to get them. And it is incredibly satisfying to know that you have played a part in making that possible.
Yeah, so important. Yeah, in your career journey from Amgen and now to Zai Labs, what are the more significant milestones that you look back on and you say, you know what, I either learned something significant at this point in my career or I've carried something forward, you know, in this point in my career because of having the experience that I've had in the past?
Yeah, I generally try to do something innovative with every product. And my job, I saw it as if there's a compound that has activity, that has a therapeutic window, that is the therapeutic potential is greater than its potential toxicity, that we ought to extract as much benefit from that drug as possible. And sometimes that means restricting the indication, as I mentioned, for instance, with the example of KRAS. Sometimes it means employing the drug in an indication that is not necessarily obvious. So one has to do laboratory work to see whether the drug works. And I was fortunate to, for instance, work on eltrombopag, and we developed it. It was supposed to be developed for thrombocytopenia, and we ended up developing the drug as well for chronic aplastic anemia. These are patients that are dependent on transfusions since childhood, and they became transfusion independent, which the NCI actually developed this drug, and we were able to get it registered and approved. The same thing with combinations. Sometimes a drug works well, but it requires another drug to make it work better or to make the toxicity better. So we developed a combination of two drugs for a particular subset of melanoma, drugs called Mekinist and Tafinlar. The same with Herceptin. We look for the pathway and figure out how to inhibit the pathway at two different levels with lapatinib and Herceptin. So always trying to do something that perhaps made the product more effective. And in the case of melanoma, actually, we were able to ameliorate some of the toxicity, particularly the skin toxicity. So these were learnings that really come from the laboratory, and they come from really not accepting the status quo, but really trying to understand the science and the biology. And it's not just obviously a single individual. This is really a long group of people that have diverse expertise. And your role when you're running a large group is really to make all this knowledge coalesce and then decide what should be tried in the clinic. So that is an incredibly satisfying part of my job. And I always continue to try to think there may be other ways to use the drug, perhaps other indications or other combinations that may make the drug more effective.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great natural transition to my next question. So as the president and global head of oncology research at Zai Labs, what are the main objectives and challenges inside of your role?
Well, In my role, I am responsible for discovery and development of drugs in oncology, discovery at large. We have other therapeutic areas, such as neuroscience, autoimmune disorders, or immunology, as well as infectious diseases. And perhaps I can just give you a few comments about Zai. Zai is about 10 years old. Recently was the 10th anniversary, and it's got 6 drugs approved in China, and it was based on open innovation. These are drugs that are de-risk, and they really address grievous illnesses, and they have really transformational effects. So we're very proud that we're focusing on diseases that are underserved. And the reason why I joined is that in addition to being able to move this pipeline of, which is a very rich pipeline in China, the company wanted to globalize and have a footprint that encompassed the rest of the world. And so for me, that was an incredible challenge that I could not let pass. So it involved in my role first building the teams that were able to develop drugs globally and then access these products. And we did this two ways. One is building laboratories. We have laboratories open in Shanghai as well as in San Diego. The laboratories have been incredibly productive. I'm very proud of that team. They are getting their first IND out by the end of the year, and several candidates are coming through. We have 3 drugs in the clinic already, to which we have global rights. That 2 of them are internal. One is through business development. And we have the goal of having 1 IND per year, either coming from internal laboratories or again from partnerships. In addition to continuing to further the pipeline in China, globalizing the company really requires a set of activities that are incredibly rewarding. And we've done this before, and the people that are joining us are people that have a lot of experience doing this. As I said, you know, three products are already ongoing, and we hope to have, at least 1 or 2 every year. We have a goal of reaching about a million patients by 2030, and we plan to launch at least 8 additional products by the end of 2025. A very lofty goal, but I think it's one that is attainable. Our pipeline is incredibly diverse, and obviously the success is never 100%, but we have enough shots on goal, I think, with very good drugs that we will be able to attain this area. And one of the challenges was where to focus, right? One cannot really try to tackle the entire area of, for instance, of cancer biology. And so we had to choose areas where we had expertise. DNA damage repair, oncogenes, antibody drug conjugates, immuno-oncology. So we have several areas where we do internal research and we do business development. And so far, we are being productive, and we hope that this continuum of drugs will continue to happen, and we'll be able to have the pipeline grow and become a real fully integrated global company.
You can always tell me that this is not something either that you can answer or that you feel like you're prepared for, but the curiosity in my mind is that the companies that I've worked with, quite frequently they'll say, hey, look, you know, we have this drug, we're going to take it, and we've developed it in the lab, we're going to go out and do clinical trials. Then they start with whatever base population either they're close to, or maybe they make a strategic choice to do the trial initially somewhere else. I'm just curious, I mean, since the since iLab started out in China and then, you know, is trying to globalize here, are you seeing that, you know, they started out maybe with all Chinese populations and then now try to broaden those clinical trials to also include, you know, people in the United States? And then also, do you see clinical trials that will start here and then go the other way? And it's like I said, it's fine if I feel like I'm hitting you with a bit of a curveball, but I think it's just a natural question whenever you sort of listen to this, to the answer that you just gave.
Yeah, no, it is definitely a natural question. And, you know, one that we've given a lot of thought, actually. We have 2,000 people in the company, you know, over 400 people in development. And the center of gravity, because the company started in China, is really in that region. But as we globalized the company, we had to establish centers in the United States, in Europe, and other countries. And we have done that through connections with cancer centers, both in Europe and the US, establishment of a scientific advisory board, connection connection with KOLs that we've known in the past. But we are really very keen on having this concept of a single R&D. So it's not China and the rest of the world. So one of the most difficult parts of oncology done is access to patients. There is a wealth of clinical trials, and there are not that many patients that are able to go into all these trials. So access to patients is critical. And so having a large footprint is a competitive advantage. And obviously, for reasons that have to do with the large population of the country, there is a wealth of patients that can be accessed in China. But we cannot do global studies just with patients in China. We do have China participate in these trials, and they can enroll, you know, 20-30% of patients or so, and then the rest of the patients will come from Europe or will come from the US. And these are for global studies. But just having the advantage of a very well-oiled machine in China that has been accruing patients for Chinese drug development is an incredible advantage. And we have partners that not only want us because we can commercialize and develop their drug in China, but because we can accrue patients to their global studies. And so the same thing is what's happening with us as we try to globalize the company. Is every single one of our phase one studies, they have sites in Europe, they may have sites in the US, they will have sites in the US, and then they have sites in China. So I think the answer is yes, we will utilize China. And as I look to Chinese tertiary care centers, which I visit many of them, I see very, very little difference in the way that medicine and oncology is practiced between the West and China. So I have no doubts that the quality and the care is similar enough that these trials can be done in a homogeneous fashion across continents.
Yeah, we were talking before we joined that, you know, I'm also a global traveler. And it's funny to me whenever I visited, you know, hospitals in other countries, you hear all of this, you know, that there's some real separation between what we see in the United States versus a lot of other countries. And the reality that I've seen in the world is that, yes, there are instances where you probably could find, you know, these differences, but also in the major, you know, healthcare centers where a lot of people are having to go, and especially for, you know, treatments like we're discussing here, you're not going to find, you know, as many, you know, differences between the different healthcare centers out there. They're going to have, you know, the top technology and be wanting to care for the patients the best they can as well. So I completely agree with you. That's why I smile whenever you said it, because I've heard this rumor, I don't know how many times, and I'm like, look, I've been in hospitals all around the world. And frankly, from my visits, I've seen a lot of things that are a lot closer to what we have versus a lot of things that are a lot different than what we have. So
absolutely. And you see this key opinion leaders and lead investigators present at ASCO, you know, global studies as well, they're global PIs. So And those are hospitals with which we have a great relationship, because we have our own CRAs, and we don't use that many vendors like CROs in China. So they know Zai very well. Zai is a very well-known entity in China. So that is also an advantage that this really well-known and world-renowned physicians know us.
Very nice. So can you tell us about any projects that you're currently really excited about at Zai Labs?
Sure. So in terms of global, we started with antibody drug conjugate against DLL3 for small cell lung cancer. That was a collaboration with a company called MediLink. It's a second generation compound, and it's moving through dose escalation at the moment quite fast. And again, that was just open in China. We have a CCR8 compound, which is also in dose escalation, moving fast. That we were able to open that in Europe, and we have several centers in Europe as well as in China and the US. And we have another global drug. This is a topical drug for psoriasis, which is starting phase two studies now. So those are the three global studies that we have. And as I said, we will have a new IND that will start in the clinic by the end of the year or early next year. And that will be followed by at least one IND per year. And then in terms of the products that are partnered, there are six of them that are licensed. And you know, everybody has their favorite product outside of oncology. Perhaps I should named Vyvgar or efgartigimod, which is a fantastic drug. It's a drug that essentially clears antibodies. So any disease of autoantibodies can be treatable with this product. And it's approved for generalized myasthenia gravis in China, and soon to be approved for chronic idiopathic demyelinating polyneuropathy, which is a very serious disease that has essentially no effective therapy. And then there will be, it's really a franchise in and of itself. There will be other indications that are under development, such as thyroid eye disease, et cetera. Perhaps the other, we have antibiotics that are solving problems of drug resistance, and a drug for schizophrenia that doesn't have the side effects of the dopamine inhibitors, the metabolic side effects particularly, called KarXT. And then in oncology, aside from the antibody drug conjugate that I mentioned before for DLL3, we have one for tissue factor for cervical cancer, which is a big problem in China. We have an antibody in collaboration with Amgen called bemarituzumab for gastric cancer, which is a big problem in China, as you know. And it's for a subset of patients that overexpress a particular molecule called FGFR2B. We have other drugs in the armamentarium, like one that's about to be approved called repotrectinib for a subset of lung cancer and a mutation or a fusion called NTRK. There are others, obviously, but it'll take me longer to go through them. But these are the ones that I am most excited about. But I am perhaps the ones that I'm most excited about are the ones that we don't yet have. And I have, that means I have great hopes that we're going to be able to access drugs that are going to be even more transformational. But we obviously have to deliver this pipeline.
Yeah, I'm always amazed as well in terms of kind of the depth and the breadth of the menu that a company is working on. And you know, I feel like your answer was directly in line with what I would expect with a company with the history of Zai Labs, right? That, you know, look, you've got a lot that you're working on. And there are, you know, there are a lot of reasons why, you know, a lot of companies have so many different things that they are working on, because you never know exactly how they're going to perform in the end. And, you know, there's still work that your team, I'm sure, is working hard to overcome, you know, every last bit of the scientific challenges as well as the regulatory challenges that are put in front of them. So it's not an easy path for sure.
Yeah, that's very true, Dan. So as we think, for instance, how to develop a drug in China, there are many different pathways, many different ways to do it. The regulations in China are becoming more and more sophisticated. The government is fostering innovation. There are many companies that may or may not be able to do clinical trials outside of China. So there's a lot of talent and products that can be accessed from that region. And if you follow the trends, there are many multinational companies that have been accessing technology from Chinese companies. And we have a sort of a foot in the door because we are there and we're able to partner with these companies. But likewise, we can partner with European companies or companies in the United States. We may need to use, you know, judgment and partner a little earlier because obviously multinational companies have means to actually acquire many more drugs. But, you know, in this field, you know, I prefer to have, you know, really high quality drug, even if it's not at the expense of a very large quantity of drugs. And so, you know, the key here is to be focused again on what area of cancer biology we want to work and be able to execute. And when it comes to China, it depends on the stage of the drug. If we're able to get in early, we can participate in the multinational study and get it approved at the same time as it gets approved, or very shortly after it gets approved by FDA. If we don't get in early, then we have to get into the post-marketing commitment trials and the randomized trials and or do bridging studies or just go through waivers. So there are many different pathways depending on the stage of the drug and also the therapeutic benefit and the risk of the drug and how one interacts with the agency to come up with a plan to get it approved.
Perfect. So can you tell me what's the greatest leadership advice that you've ever received?
That's really a great question. I think it starts with really having great people. Nothing gets done without great people in I think in any industry, but this is really clearly a team effort, and it requires expertise from discovery all the way through medical affairs and commercialization. So finding people that have the drive, the intelligence, but more importantly, at least for me, is the collaborative spirit. I always think that I can find smart people, but finding smart people that are willing to put patients first and also think about the business, but think about, you know, how quick can I get this approved with the best quality, speed, and again, extracting as much benefit from the drug, and put that ahead of your ego. That's critical for me when I think about hiring. And then once I do that, I want to stretch these people and be able to tell them this is the mission, this is the project, you know, set direction, and then support them. And that was probably the best advice that I ever received is, you know, you have to support individuals from below, clear obstacles out of their way, and stop giving directions top down. And so I try to do that. I change my mind when I'm given data that is contradictory to what I think. I don't care about rank. All I care about is that if you're smart and you're right, I'm going to do my best to support you. And all I need to know is what is it that you need from me to be able to do your work.
It is such great advice, right? I mean, the leader's job, you know, overall is set the vision, step out of the way, be there to kind of check in and understand what's happening, you know, not completely let go of the steering wheel, you know, while the car's, you know, moving down the road. But at the same time, not being such a control freak that you're, you know, you're disrupting kind of what people need to go get done as well. And so it's not an easy thing to learn, I feel like. As leaders grow, it's one of those things where you got to learn how to, even though you might know the way to do something, you need to, you know, feel comfortable enough in your team to let them do it as well.
Yeah, that's very true, Don, because it's very easy to think that because you've been doing this for a long time, you're always right. And that's a fallacy. Of course, experience is really important. I mean, knowing regulatory jurisprudence, knowing competitive intelligence, and all of this is accumulated, you know, through years of work and being in the space. But sometimes that's done at the expense of creativity and, you know, sort of bringing in new talent, people that can think differently, and try not to stifle it just because it doesn't sound familiar. It's very critical just to say, okay, let me give some thought. That actually, you know, sounds like something that we could potentially tweak and propose. And I always found that regulators are pretty open to what sponsors come through. They want, obviously, whatever idea gets put in front of them to be backed up by data. But if it makes scientific sense it shortens the time to approval and it demonstrates the therapeutic benefit of the product and it's potentially, let's say, an innovative clinical trial design, they're going to be open to it. They won't be open to it if you don't suggest it, but if you try, you know, they may bring their own experts and tell you, okay, let's work together to design this study. You know, perhaps you can get approval based on response and maybe full approval, you know, based on the ultimate endpoint. I mean, there are different ways to work with regulators, and I've, at least in my experience, the best people that I've worked with at FDA, EMA, CDE are people that are open to creative ways to actually get drugs developed in a safe manner.
Also true. What inspires you?
Patients. I remember, you know, many of them, as I said before, I know that they're waiting. I know that there's a lot to do. The vast majority of tumors are solid tumors. Liquid tumors have benefited a lot from gene and cell therapy, particularly myeloma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We still need to democratize that space, and there are ways to do that with in vivo delivery and other technologies that we're thinking about, but that's not really the majority of tumors. The majority are solid tumors, and metastatic tumors are difficult to treat. Melanoma is a success story, but even that disease, you know, there's a lot of patients that relapse and end up succumbing to it. There's been advancements, but most of them prolong survival and they don't necessarily eradicate the disease. So making inroads every year into curing or prolonging survival is really key inspiration. And the other is the scientific and intellectual satisfaction that one gets from looking at data. I mean, sometimes you're the first person to know the results of some study. The first person tends to be the statistician, which I am jealous of. But very quickly, you know, you can sit down with him or her and start understanding the data. And, you know, that particularly when it actually, you know, points in a direction where you think you already have a drug, is super satisfying, because then you gain momentum and you can start mobilizing, and you know, people get energized and things happen very quickly. And if the data is negative, that's equally important. You have to really be humble and know that biology is sometimes going to disappoint. And what you cannot do is keep moving the goalpost, because you will never kill a drug that really doesn't have a future. So looking at data is important, both on the positive side and the negative side. But at the end of the day, you do that because there's a patient at the end of the line that needs your help. So that is really the primary objective of what we do.
Yeah, also important. What concerns you?
When I think about this field, what concerns me is that we haven't really improved the process very much, at least not as much as other industries have. It still takes a long time to get drugs approved, and it takes a lot of money to get drugs approved. You know, with the help of regulators, we've gotten more drugs approved, and I think it's doubled during my career now, the number of drugs that actually get to the market. But when you look at oncology is about 45% of all the drugs that are under development, including all the other therapeutic areas, and it's made of a lot of me too drugs or me better drugs in areas that are proven, targets that are proven, particularly immuno-oncology in the recent past. And it's also made the rest from ultra segmented groups. So signal transduction, mutations that are developed under the pressure of an inhibitor, for instance, then there are secondary and tertiary drugs. That, yeah, they improve the prevalence of the disease and they get patients going as if it was a chronic disease. But the number of patients is so small that it's hard to access them. So access to patients, length of clinical trial, the length of the development process is frustrating. But I see some light at the end of the tunnel. For instance, with the aid of AI, we could probably discover drugs sooner, and there are now some companies that are dedicated to that. Still, perhaps to be proven, but a lot of hope goes into that, and I have no doubt that it's going to help us beyond what we traditionally do nowadays. And then other ways of executing clinical trials, you know, modern ways to design trials with perhaps fewer patients. Ways to maybe do risk-based monitoring or risk-based quality so that we don't actually check every single parameter, which ends up being sometimes a waste. And also picking drugs that have a big treatment effect. The bigger the treatment effect, the smaller the study one needs to actually demonstrate it. So in the past, there's been trials with 1,000 patients. Those are a thing of the past because, you know, they take many years to fulfill. So, you know, getting drugs that we think are going to have a big treatment effect so that we can demonstrate it with 200, 300 patients and then move very fast. So again, I am very hopeful that, you know, as we learn all these lessons, the technology helps us. We will be able to do more with less, particularly as the science improves and gives us targets that are tractable and that make a big difference in the natural history of the disease.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be wonderful to see the output of acceleration as well. What excites you?
Well, I think there's just so much to do, I think that one has to be an optimist to be in this field, because obviously there are failures, but more and more there are fewer failures. I remember when, you know, the number of failures in phase three was high. Now a failure in phase three is a tragedy. Nobody should really be launching phase three studies. without having good certainty that it's going to be positive. And so that improvement is, incredibly energizing. I think the wealth of targets is incredible. I mean, when I go to JP Morgan or meet with other companies and I see what they're working on, it forces me to actually go back to the literature and start reading and start talking to multiple experts in the field. And in the end, I become an expert myself in that area. And I love to learn. I'm very curious. And it helps me make a decision. And sometimes the decision is not just based on the science. It's based on, can we afford to do this? Because if we do this, we may not be able to do that. We have to choose. Or, the competition is ahead of us, or, there may be other reasons, but, in the process, one learns a lot about that pathway. And there are never two drugs that are the same. So, sometimes we go in and we know that there are other drugs in the same pathway. And we think that we believe, like it's been demonstrated in many diseases, that there's room for more than one drug in the same biological theme. So I think it's the pace of science, the fact that we every year there that I go to ASCO or ESMO or any of these scientific meetings, there are breakthrough discoveries that make a huge impact in the natural history of the disease, and the fact that I can play, even if it's a small role, in making that a reality. To me, there's really nothing better, to spend your time doing. Forming teams, growing talent is also fantastic. Working with great people and then being part of this community. It is really indeed a community that appears to be very large, but it's not that large. I think the longer you are in this business, the smaller it seems.
Yeah, we all seem to stumble across each other at different points, don't we?
Yeah, well, that's right.
Well, Dr. Rafael Amato, thank you so much for being on the Life Science Success Podcast. Thank you for being here and telling us everything that's going on at Zai Labs. And I look forward to hopefully getting to meet you in person and get to hear more about, all the exciting things that you're getting to work on. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you. I would love that.
Thank you for listening to Life Science Success. For complete details about this podcast, including show notes, how to get in touch with guests, and more episodes, please visit www.lifescienceaccess.com. If there's someone you'd like for us to invite to the show as a guest, please let me know by sending me a message at the podcast website. Please click subscribe on your favorite podcast app, share the podcast, or tell a friend about it, and last but not least, rate the podcast. Thank you again.